Father, bless these words to our hearts in Jesus' name. Turn in your Bibles, please, to Genesis chapter 1. And we are going to continue today the creation series, and this will be the third part. In verse 21, the Word of God says, God created the great whales and every living creature that moves, which the waters brought forth abundantly after their kind, and every winged fowl after his kind. And God saw that it was good. And in verse 24, and God said, let the earth bring forth the living creatures after his kind, cattle and creeping thing, and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. One of the top principles of biology is that everything reproduces after its own kind. This is very important for us to understand. Everything reproduces after its own kind. Biologists understand that extremely well. Everything reproduces after its own kind. If we are going to discuss creation versus evolution, then we have to understand a little bit about biology. And it's what the Bible says here, that everything reproduces after its own kind. That is established in genetics. Evolution is said to be a genetic phenomenon. And so in order to be able to fully understand the debate that's happening between creationists and evolutionists, we have to have some rudimentary understanding of DNA, of genetics. Now, when I say genetics, don't be intimidated. I'm not teaching you genetics. You can get a PhD in genetics. I'm not going to cover it in 40 minutes. I'm going to give you just some of the rudimentary understanding, very basic, extremely basic, for people to be able to understand what it is that's being spoken of when we're talking about something like mutations or fitness or adaptation, because these are all genetic issues. Natural selection is a genetic issue. Evolution is said to be all about population genetics, not individual genetics, population genetics. In other words, the gene pool found in the population. So if we're going to understand that, we need to understand a little bit about DNA, which is what makes up genetics. First, we're going to talk for a few moments about the structure of DNA. This is very basic biology. A DNA molecule looks like a twisted ladder. I mean, most people have seen the pictures, at least on commercials or somewhere. It looks like a twisted ladder. The ladder has rungs, and the DNA molecule can be said in this analogy to have rungs, like a ladder. The rungs are made of two parts. It has a sugar backbone and a phosphate group. Now, whether you know that or not, doesn't matter that it's sugar and phosphate. What I want you to understand is that there's these little portions of DNA called bases. Two bases put together make up one of these rungs on this DNA ladder. There's four bases in all that are found in what biologists would call eukaryotic organisms. In other words, complex organisms. Simple organisms like bacteria have four bases also, and plants along with them, but they have one base that's different than most other organisms. Now, in our body, in the body of all mammals, in the bodies of all complex cellular organisms, and we are multicellular organisms in a biological way of speaking, and each of our cells is a complex cell, there are these four bases. There's adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine. Don't worry about the names. typically they are simply spoken of using the first letter of those names. So A, T, C, and G. It's like an alphabet. DNA is very similar to an alphabet. If you take the alphabet and you arrange the letters in a specific way, you give them meaning. If you arrange the letters haphazardly, they have no meaning. They're just letters. But if you arrange the letters in a specific way, they will have meaning. Any idea whatsoever can be conveyed in the English language using 26 letters. It doesn't matter what the idea is. Absolutely any idea you can come up with can be conveyed in the English language using 26 letters. DNA is a similar language. DNA has 4 letters. And there may be somebody out there who says, well, you can't certainly be as complex with 4 letters as you can be with 26 letters. You most certainly can be complex. Morse code has 2 letters. And you can convey absolutely any idea whatsoever in Morse code. It doesn't matter about the complexity of the idea. You can convey it in 2 letters. Well, DNA has twice as many letters to work with as Morse code. And so it's more than enough for any sort of complexity that might be required. Bases pair up. And it's very important for us to understand. The 2 legs of the ladder are simply 2 chains of bases that are properly paired up. A will always pair with T. C will always pair with G. So if you have A on one side of the ladder, you will have a T on the other. The complementary base in that rung, the 2 bases together, form what's called a base pair, which you could use in this analogy as a rung on the ladder. Wherever there's an A, there will be a T. Wherever there is a C, there will be a G. Vice versa also. If you see a T, you know there is an A. If you see a G, you will know there's a C. That's just the way they pair up. That is very important. When DNA replicates, and we'll talk mostly about complex organisms since we are biologically considered complex organisms, and this is true with any complex cell. Now, when I say complex cell, I want to be clear here. A complex cell can still be fairly simple. What defines a cell as being complex is that its internal structures are cordoned off by membranes. In other words, you have a cellular membrane, and within the cell you have something called organelles. Those can be likened to the organs of the cell, hence the word organelle. These are extremely small, and each different type of organelle has a very specific function. For example, one type of organelle is a mitochondria. You might have heard of mitochondria, and they are responsible for producing cellular energy. There's all kinds of different types of organelles. A nucleus is a type of an organelle where all the DNA is located. Various different types, lots of different types of organelles found in cells, many, many different types. The unique thing is that they are all characterized by having a membrane around them. In a simple organism, the internal structures are not membrane bound. In a complex organism, they are. That's it. That's the difference. That's the big difference. Now, that's very general. There's other differences also, but those differences aren't really unnecessary to understand for a discussion of evolution so much. The twisted ladder is called a double helix. Maybe you've heard that term. It's called a double helix. So DNA is a double helix molecule. When DNA reproduces, the two legs of the ladder separate. In organisms such as humans or other mammals, in most complex organisms, a cell will reproduce by dividing in half. At that point, one half of the double helix molecule, in other words, one leg of the ladder, will go to one offspring or daughter cell, and the other portion will go to the other daughter cell. So a cell splits in two, you have two daughter cells, each of them gets one of the legs of the ladder. In other words, it gets a full complement of the bases without the complementary base attached. So it'll get the A, but it won't get the T. Now further down, it may have a T, but that won't have the complementary A attached. This is called semi-conservative replication. In other words, part of the DNA is original with the parent. And then the cell will synthesize another leg of the ladder, another string of DNA, to complement the template strand. And so when it's synthesizing the new DNA portion, it has reading machinery and machinery to synthesize, and the machinery reads an A, and it brings in a T to connect to the A, a complement. And then it reads a C, and it'll bring in a G. And then it reads a T, and it'll bring in an A, and so on. And so it reproduces the original strand. So in the end, both daughter strands, even though they received each the opposite complement, because of semi-conservative replication, each daughter strand will then synthesize a molecule that is identical to the one that was in the parent cell. And now you have DNA replication. It's that simple. Now, human DNA has 3 billion base pairs. That's a lot. That is like taking 1,500 page volumes in 10-point font. That's how much information is contained in every single cell in your body. So in the nucleus, not even utilizing the entire cell, just in the nucleus of your cells, each one of them has information that you could put into 1,000 volumes of 500-page books. That's astonishingly complex. This is the information that gives the cell instructions how to make whatever it is that it needs to make. Ultimately, how to make you. The cells receive their initial DNA from the parents, literally. In other words, you have a mom, you have a dad, each of them contribute one half of a strand. That's the unique thing about the gametes, or the sex cells. They are the only cells in the human body or in any mammalian body that have only half the complement of the DNA. The sperm gives one strand, one leg of the DNA, and the egg gives the other half. And then when the two chromatids join, you will have a full DNA molecule. Each parent contributes 23 chromosomes thereby. The father contributes 23, the mother contributes 23, and then you have a full set with a zygote, which is a fertilized egg that contains 46 chromosomes in humans. The biological definition of life from any given species is when you have a living cell, a fertilized egg, that now has the full set, the full complement of DNA for that species. In other words, that's where life begins. These people that say, well, life may not begin at conception, that's nonsense. The fertilized egg is alive, and it has a full set of DNA. what defines us as human, what defines any species as the species that it is the DNA that's present. Once you have a fertilized egg with a full complement of human DNA, you have a living human being. I don't care what you want to say about your political statements. I don't care what you want to say about your preferences for social issues. It doesn't make a hill of beans a difference. The biology tells us what it actually is. Once you have a fertilized egg and it has a full complement of DNA, you have a living organism of that species. Now, one time in a billion, during replication of DNA, an error will be made. That's not bad. Imagine making a one in a billion time error. You do something a billion times and you only make an error once. That means that if you have an A, it'll hook it up to a C or a G. It won't hook it up to a T. Now, I mentioned before that there are four, and that in plants and very simple organisms, single cellular, non-complex organism, it's not a T, it's a molecule called uracil or a U. And in plants, A hooks up to U and C hooks up to G. But we're not going to worry about that. We're not talking about plants. We're talking about people. When there is an error made, the rung on the ladder will not be formed. And the reason is, you have these two bases, and there are chemical bonds that are normally formed between the two bases. If the bond is not correct, in other words, if the two bases are not complementary, like an A and a C, then the bond between those two bases will not form. The result is that on the leg portion of the DNA, you'll have a bump because the bond didn't form. And so instead of being held together in that portion of the DNA, it doesn't hold together, and you simply have a string and then a bump, and then it continues normally. There is proofreading material in the cell. That proofreading machine, after the DNA molecule is made, will read everything along the molecule, and it looks for bumps. When it finds a bump, it will take out the incorrect base, it'll literally cut it out, and it'll bring in a correct base, and then it'll insert the correct base. When there is a change, a mistake like that, that's called a mutation. Sometimes mutations can survive. One of the ways for mutations to survive is if the proofreading material cuts out the wrong base. It can actually replace the incorrect thing. And now you have what's called a point mutation. In other words, a mutation within a single base. The vast majority of mutations are eliminated. If, for some reason, the DNA proofreading machine does not get it right, there's other mechanisms also. One of the ways that the body takes care of itself, and these are redundant mechanisms. I'm not going to go into every single mechanism. We'd be here all day. But these are redundant mechanisms. In other words, your cells have many mechanisms. But if a mutation gets through, whatever is being made by the cell, whatever's present in the cell, there's a marker for it on the surface. It's almost like a menu. In this cell, you will find all these different things, and it's on the surface. Your immune system, which is really regulated in your thymus gland, will be programmed in embryonic development. At that time, there is a catalog made, if you will, an accounting made of everything that is present within the body of the developing organism. And the catalog is an absolute, minute detail. If it's present, it's cataloged. I don't care how small it is, I don't care how trivial or insignificant. If it is present, it's cataloged. Therefore, the body is programmed to recognize itself. The way that the immune system works is if it doesn't recognize something as belonging, it attacks it. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't belong there. That means your immune system is able to handle absolutely anything whatsoever. Something comes from deep space, never been seen on Earth before. Your immune system can handle it. Why? Because it's not self. It was not present in early 4-month embryonic development. It's not self. If it's not self, it's recognized as foreign. If it's foreign, it's attacked. Now, the mechanisms of that, we're not going to get into. Suffice to say that if it wasn't present at 4 months of embryonic development, it's seen as foreign. When there is a mutation that takes place within the DNA, it will be announced by the cell as something that is now present in the cell. The immune system is constantly working and reading what's in the cells to make sure everything is what is supposed to be there. Once it reads something, or once it finds something that doesn't belong, that was not there at 4 months of development, it labels it as foreign and it attacks it and it destroys it. That's the last line of defense, really. There's multiple redundant proofreading machinery, things to protect yourselves, and if you can't protect it, the immune system will destroy it. And so, things like mutations really have a difficult time of surviving. Now, the big question is, where did the DNA come from? And scientists tell us that there were some inorganic molecules at the bottom of an ocean. They know this because this is what they made up. There's, and literally, I'm not saying that facetiously or sarcastically, they literally just made this up. That at the bottom of the ocean, there were some inorganic molecules. And then somehow, those inorganic molecules came together in a meaningful way to form the first rudimentary portion of genetic material, be it DNA or RNA or some prehistoric precursor to DNA or RNA, the two types of genetic material that are present. And then somehow, because in order to have a living cell, you have to separate it from its environment, a membrane of some sort formed itself around the genetic material, which just somehow, over millions of years, came together in a meaningful way. When I was in college, I had a professor who would say, there was this inorganic material at the bottom of the ocean, TSO, the inorganic material came together in a meaningful way, TSO, a membrane formed around the material, TSO, it reproduced. TSO means then something occurred. And that is about how it works. Now, the professor was an intellectually honest guy. He was a good guy. He would always preface everything by saying, if this is in fact true. Most scientists are not dishonest people. Some are. Most are not. Most scientists, including professors, if they are honest, they will say things like, if this is in fact the case, if this is how things took place, because they'll acknowledge that they don't actually know that this is how things took place, that this is just a theory. The people who say it's not a theory are the people who are trying to peddle something. But no honest scientists will say this is not a theory. The honest scientists say this is a theory. And then even if they believe and accept the theory, they will admit this is a theory, and then they will say something like, if this is in fact the case, and then they will present whatever it is they want to present. How all these things are supposed to have taken place, nobody knows. The notion that it took place at the bottom of the ocean is extremely problematic. And the reason why it's so problematic is because it's supposed to have taken place over millions of years. Never mind random chance putting together vast quantities of molecules in a meaningful way. But over millions of years, you're supposed to have had this organic material sitting at the bottom of the ocean, waiting for the next piece to line up correctly, waiting for the next piece to line up correctly, waiting for the next piece to line up correctly, over all these eons, and somehow they never got buried in the sand. That's the marvelous nature of evolution. Somehow, magically, miraculously even, it all seemed to have worked out, according to the evolutionist theory. Then, as these molecules reproduced, they started to form populations. The populations then are said to have specialized in their structures, realizing that it would be easier to work together than to work separately. And then, they came together in these multicellular organisms, TSO. Now, there is one major question. As all these early things were evolving, they had to reproduce. Evolution is a reproductive population phenomenon in theory. Populations are set to evolve, not individuals. Individuals introduce mutations into the populations. The environment will select or reject the mutations according to the advantage it may or disadvantage that it may give to the individual to survive in its environment. And then those for whom it is an advantage, those mutations are then passed on to offspring, and through generations they spread throughout the population, is how the theory goes. Now, the question is, and this is a significant problem. This is an enormous problem. How did those early populations get produced? In other words, once you got that molecule that's covered in a membrane with genetic information, and it reproduced, how did it reproduce? How did the early reproduction, or any reproduction for that matter, evolve? The reason why that is a question is because even the simplest forms of reproduction are highly complex. They require numerous sophisticated structures and systems within the simplest of cells. So if you have a very simple cell, even if it should happen to be alive, it doesn't have the ability to reproduce. An example of this is a virus. Viruses by themselves have no ability to reproduce. If you have a single viral cell, and like I said, they are the simplest organisms known to exist. They're so simple, not everybody's convinced they're even alive. They have no ability to reproduce. So viruses have to invade host cells and utilize the host cell's machinery in order to reproduce. Well, without the ability to reproduce, there is no population. Let me say that again. Without the ability to reproduce, there is no population. Without the ability to reproduce, there is no possibility for evolution. To say that an early population arose and evolved is nonsense. There is no ability for a population to exist unless it's already evolved the mechanisms for reproduction. There is no ability to evolve mechanisms for reproduction without a population. Because evolution is a population phenomenon, the theory tells us. In other words, you have a theory that excludes itself with two different points of the theory. You need reproduction, you need population when there is no ability for either. And this is a significant problem. That problem alone, in my view, totally discredits the notion of evolution. Now, the last point we're going to make today, and we'll end with this, is evolution of what? Well, the notion is evolution of species. So that begs the question, what is a species? And if you think about it, you may say it's both hard and easy to define. You'll recognize a horse as a species. You'll recognize an orchid as a species. And if you put an orchid next to a horse, you will, without any trouble, recognize that they are different species. So let me ask you something. If you have an elephant and a clam, are they different species? Most people would say, obviously, they are different species, and that's true. If you have a zebra and a dog, are they different species? And most people, without any trouble, would say, yes, they are different species. If you have a rat and a gerbil, are they different species? Now people would say, oh, yeah, they're going to be a different species. But now it's coming into, well, yeah, they are, but they're still kind of similar. But most people would say there are different species. It's certainly true. How about this one? You have a moth and a butterfly. Are they different species? And once again, most people would say they are a different species. Although they would by now recognize that, yeah, there's a lot of similarities between different species. How about another one? Plasmodium falciparum and Plasmodium vivax. Both of these are malarial parasites. Both of them will give you malaria. Are they different species? And sometimes people say, well, if they both give you malaria, maybe they're the same species. In fact, if you know how things are named in biology, if you know the nomenclature, you'll recognize that they are different species. The genus is Plasmodium. The species is Falciparum versus Vivax. How about this one? The virus that causes smallpox and the virus that causes cowpox, are they different species? What do you think? And most people will think of the name, well, smallpox versus cowpox, probably there are different species. There is a question about that one. If you inoculate someone with cowpox virus, which is harmless to humans, they will become immune to smallpox, which is deadly to humans. So are they different species? Here's the problem with evolution. Evolution of what? Well, evolution of species. Okay, we're saying evolution of species, but we can't actually define what a species is. Defining a species is very tricky biologically. Very difficult to do. Now, if the DNA is sufficiently different, we can say, oh, they're different species. But sometimes, the full story, number one, is not in the DNA, because, let me put it this way, people who form relationships between organisms and categorize these relationships on the basis of DNA now think that a cow is more related to a whale than a mouse is to a rat. And so that doesn't always work out for us. I have never seen a sea-dwelling cow or a whale you could milk. Now, the other thing is that it's not only all in the DNA, but even if the DNA is different, everyone's DNA is different. You and I don't have the same DNA. Only twins have the same DNA. Yet, clearly, all humans are the same species. You see, what I'm saying is this question of species is not as clear as it may actually appear if you don't know how biology works. Biologists have a definition for species devised in 1949 by a guy named Mayer. And he said that organisms belong to two different species if they are separated by pre- or post-zygotic mechanisms preventing them from forming reproductively viable offspring. Now, that's a mouthful that actually doesn't say a whole lot. What it means is this, that either because they cannot conceive or because of something that happens after conception, two organisms cannot produce offspring that can reproduce after their own kind. That's what it's saying. Now, that definition alone has its set of problems. For example, prezygotic mechanism or preconception mechanisms can involve behavioral or physical characteristics. Yet, we have species that are separated by these types of mechanisms, but they're still within the same species. In other words, the two organisms cannot bring themselves together to fertilize an egg. Well, I've never seen a Great Dane mixed with a Chihuahua, at least not naturally occurring, yet both of those are the same species, different breeds, but same species. That is a prezygotic mechanism separating that, and by definition, they should be different species, but they're not. That's not the only case that you get out there like that. You see, the whole notion of a species is very difficult to define. So when an evolutionist says, well, the species have evolved, the question is, how do you define species? We're talking about the evolution of something undefined. And the whole notion that all these different species have evolved is problematic when you can't define what evolved. What exactly is a species? What makes something different as a species than something else? Because the notion of pre- or post-zygotic mechanisms preventing the formation of reproductively viable offspring doesn't really hold up. And so what evolved? If you can't define what is evolving, you can't even really define evolution.